From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. On this week's show, a local psychologist treats victims of priest sexual abuse.
A lot of people derive a lot of strength in their life from a healthy faith. And when that faith is shaken, that source of strength is removed.
Missouri legislators face dramatic budget cuts this year, and a KU archaeologist tackles the myth of the Mayan calendar and ends up fascinated by U.S.-based mythology.
I see it as a really interesting phenomenon in contemporary society that may very well result in the creation of some new religious traditions.
Plus, an opera aimed at young people.
It's Casey Currents. Listen up just after this news. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
Recent events in Kansas City have raised a new public furor about abuse by Catholic priests, but no one really knows how long the problem itself has been going on. According to the Survivors Network for those abused by priests, nearly 16,000 abuse victims have spoken out since 1950. That's around the country. Some courts, like in California, are deliberating over how far back claims of abuse can be made. But for the victims, the emotional aftermath of being abused by a priest can have no expiration date. For insight into the healing process, Susan spoke with Lawrence Neeters, a psychologist who works with priest abuse victims.
Predators have an instinct in terms of just knowing who's available, who can be reached. They look for vulnerable children, children from broken families, or from troubled families, the quote-unquote lost child kind of a role that children get into. An absent father, he could be away with business, but he could also be away in military. So a predator will come in and then fill in an empty spot in the boy's life and sometimes in the family's life. Many times predators will insinuate themselves into the structure of the family such that he's a welcome guest and they feel privileged to have him come for supper and to take their son on camping trips and be involved far more than he would be with other families and other children. So oftentimes there's a sense of privilege that is used and misused in cases like this.
And a lot has been talked about how predators groom potential victims. What does that grooming process look like?
Well, you know, you say grooming, you can also say seduction. And seduction is a process. And it just is, it's over time. It's not rushed. It's a little at a time, a little bit closer and a little bit closer. In psychology, we talk a lot about boundaries. Personal space. What belongs to you and where do you belong? And predators know how to just very quietly and patiently erode these boundaries so that, you know, if this wasn't such a big deal, well this can't be either. And little by little, and it could be 6 months, it could be a year, producing the kind of connection, the kind of attachment between the child and himself. And eventually it goes into something that's very dark. That if he tried that the first time, the kid would scream, the kid would run out, the kid would yell, the kid would be shocked. The point that a predator finally makes a serious move, the child has been seduced into accepting this, that, the next, and this isn't any different from the last time. And then it's like the monster finally swallows the prey.
So from a parent's point of view, what kind of signs or signals would they see from their child that this was happening to, particularly given your comment about how often this predator wins the trust of families?
You watch for changes, rather radical changes in the child's mood, behavior, school performance. An outgoing child that rather suddenly becomes more isolative, a compliant, friendly child that becomes more angry or frightened, a child who's done very well in school and then all of a sudden is doing very poorly. A child that, you know, with the trusted quote-unquote friend who says, I don't want to do that anymore. I don't want to go. Don't make me go. These would be things to follow up. Let's talk about what's going on here. What's the matter?
What do you find is unique and different about the cases that you see where a priest is involved versus other predators at large?
Well, for one thing, priests have a very esteemed place in the Catholic community. For instance, these are vicars of Christ. These are Christ stand-ins. In the era past, the men that I'm seeing come from backgrounds like my own, where priests would never be questioned or challenged, and it would be a privilege indeed to have a priest show special interest to the family. So first of all, there's a high prestige value and a lot of respect and reverence to the priest. What's unique is also what the priest stands for, and that he is the stand-in for a godly figure. And when a priest oversteps his bounds and steps into the predator role, it's so absolutely confusing for the child, and especially if parents aren't getting it, and they keep encouraging the child to be in the company of the predator. Very, very confusing for the child. Sometimes parents actually get angry with the child for balking because it's keeping the family from having the prestige of the priest coming to visit.
One effect that this seems to have is it really shakes people's beliefs about their religion, their faith to the core. What kind of impacts have you seen with that effect?
Well, a lot of people derive a lot of strength in their life from a healthy faith. And when that faith is shaken, that source of strength is removed. And in addition to that, we're looking at children again. Children are trying to figure out what happened and why. And if the conclusion is God hates me, or God is punishing me, or somehow I deserve this, that's a felt belief. It's not a rational belief, but it's an emotionally based belief that can last a lifetime if it's not dealt with and challenged and replaced with one that's more accurate. So if God hates me, then we're taking a look at where does somebody go from there? What we've got then is the makings of despair. And we've seen here in our community reports of suicides that have occurred. And that's I think we can trace some of the suicide to that sense of despair where not even God wants me, or not even God is watching out for me.
Now, when this happens to boys, often it can happen at a time when the sexual identity is still forming. What impacts have you seen on the sexual identity of boys that this happens to early on while they're still forming their identity in this area?
It varies, and it varies with the child. Some boys will kind of gather the inner strength that they need and connect with adequate males and with peers and will develop a healthy sense of sexual identity, male sexual identity. Others are devastated and have deep, deep-seated questions in terms of what does this mean about me? What am I, fish or fowl, so to speak? Again, that can last a lifetime. In response to that, especially in our culture tends to be non-accepting of a gay lifestyle. And especially that would be the case in the really traditional religious families. And again, that can lead to despair, which somebody tries to medicate by virtue of drugs, alcohol, sexual acting out, all sorts of different addictive behaviors in order to quell some of the distress that's inside in terms of who am I after all?
Well, yeah, I can imagine if I'm a boy that this happens to, there's a part of me that's thinking, well, because this happened, that must mean I'm homosexual, and so therefore I am.
Yes, and a predator knows how to feed on that, saying, well, see, you wanted this, you enjoyed this. I couldn't help myself. You're the reason that this happened.
Another complicating factor, I would imagine, and you were talking about sometimes this happens to fatherless boys or boys where there might be some chaos in the family. And if that's the case, what about instances where a victim may, on the one hand, abhor and be frightened by that kind of contact? On the other hand, be, I wouldn't say welcoming of it, but enjoy some aspects of it because it's attention, it's a special relationship.
Makes a lot of conflict, and the child typically concludes, there's something wrong with me. I'm bad, I'm wrong, I'm causing this to happen, it's my fault. And again, a perpetrator, knowing the psyche of a child, is going to endorse that and will strengthen that belief. And of course, if the child believes that he's bad, well, he's sure not going to display that any. So then the perpetrator can come around and be a buddy. And there's the acceptance. And yes, you really are a good boy, and I understand. We just won't talk about this.
And that's part of the difficulty too, isn't it? That a child then is in this realm of secrecy and all of the problems that can cause.
Secrecy is simply a trap. It's a trap that swallows the child, and the child has nowhere to go. There's no one to tell, and which means not only to tell his story, but then to get some feedback, to get some information that might conflict with what he's been told. So it's a very, very dark place that a child winds up. And again, because part of that is the threat of, if I do tell, there are these dire consequences that'll happen, and I'll just have to keep this to myself.
Now, of course, many of these boys grew up to be men who never have told. What kinds of issues do you find people that never tell, and finally, when they become adults, begin to deal with these issues? What kinds of symptoms do they have as adults?
A lot of this can be blocked out, pushed to the back, put on the other side of the wall, so to speak, and put their lives together and continue on. But then when one of their children comes of age, at the age at which certain things have happened, all of a sudden that wall starts to crumble, and the adult begins to become aware of what's been pushed back for so long.
How do you help people heal from this kind of trauma?
I think that the main thing is to be a good listener, and to be a listener who's listening for what it was like for them, not facts. I'm not a fact-gathering, forensic, police type of person. It's more, what was it like for you, and what did you go through, and what effect did that have on you then, and is it having on you now, and how is that interfering with you living a constructive, peaceful sort of life? How is it playing out in relationships? This is a big one. You mentioned trust. Trust is paramount in order to have a healthy, intimate relationship with somebody, that mutual trust, that letting your guard down and letting yourself be real with somebody. This is mission impossible for a lot of folks because, and maybe not even on a conscious level, it just doesn't feel right. I just don't go there, or I can't go there. A spouse can be calling for more emotional closeness, physical closeness, and many times the survivor just can't go there.
Lawrence Neeters is an Overland Park psychologist who has worked with people who are abused by priests.
Coming up, an expert on the ancient Maya sets the record straight on 2012. You're listening to Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Missouri lawmakers return to session this week, and they face a multitude of tasks. But front and center is the state's budget. As KCUR's Alana Gordon reports, Missouri faces a challenging year, with a major source of revenue running out, and an economy that's still struggling to recover from the recession.
If you talk with just about anyone from Kansas City's legislative caucus, they'll tell you pretty much the same thing about the state's budget situation this year. Not good.
It's going to be obviously a very somber session when you're talking about the budget numbers that we're looking at.
Missouri is literally going to fall off, well, I guess not literally, but Missouri is going to fall off a cliff in 2012 as far as our budget is concerned.
State Representative Mike Talboy, Senator Jolie Justice, both Democrats, and others are bracing for a budget shortfall of hundreds of millions of dollars that's no longer cushioned by federal stimulus funds. The state has used nearly $3 billion in federal stimulus money since the recession hit in 2008. But stimulus funds from Washington have dried up. House Budget Chair Ryan Silvey, a Republican, says Missouri has been preparing for this. But even so, it's going to be tough.
When the economy started to turn down, the federal government started sending federal stabilization dollars or stimulus dollars. So that money was placed into the budget over the last few years so that we made smaller cuts along the way in the hopes that unemployment would turn around and that people would have jobs by the time the stimulus money ran out. Well, we're at the end and unemployment is still 9%. So now we have to figure out how to bring our budget into alignment with actual revenue, not propped up by the federal money.
And that means up to $700 million in cuts, according to Sylvie. The situation is a little different across the state line. Kansas used up the end of its stimulus dollars last year. The state dealt with a nearly $500 million deficit, making some tough cuts to human services, raising the state sales tax, and using one-time state highway funds to help plug the hole. Now Kansas is entering the coming year with a small surplus. Back in Missouri, State Budget Director Linda Lubering says this year's lack of stimulus funds, combined with the loss of other one-time funds and reduced Medicaid payments, means the state's now dealing with a total loss of about $750 million. But Lubering says at least one factor is likely to ease the pain.
We're expecting growth of $285 million in revenue.
Revenue's up, with a projected growth rate on par with years prior to the recession. But Amy Bluen, with the Missouri Budget Project, says even so, this growth is based off a very low revenue base. Very low.
Following 2008, it dipped significantly. The steepest declines in the state since the Great Depression.
So with less money overall, Bluen estimates it will take another 4 years for Missouri to return to pre-2008 funding levels. In the meantime, without other revenue sources, that leaves the state with some hard decisions to make. Bluen says even if the resulting size of the budget cuts aren't any bigger than years before, the impact this year will be greater.
We've spent so many years reducing services, one year on top of the next, that there are no cuts left in the state budget that will not be very painful.
Bluen says whether that's reducing the number of state employees, the level of health services, or childcare. State Representative Mike Talboy says the situation is unfortunate.
We really have to figure out where as a society and a state that now that we are going to hit rock bottom from this financial cliff that we're going to see this year, how we then move on from there and how we progress forward in the next coming years and rebuild ourselves.
But he says given the state's financial situation and the absence of stimulus funds, lawmakers will first be faced with cutting past the fat and into the bone of state programs. Alana Gordon, KCUR News.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
It is a doomsday that is foretold in the Mayan calendar. The Chinese oracle of the I Ching. Even an internet-based prophetic software program. 2012.
2012 is here, much to the terror of some of the world's doomsayers. It's the year that the ancient Mayans are said to have predicted the end of the world. Not so, say scholars of the Mayan civilization, who lived and live today in Mexico and Central America. Among those scholars is John Hoops, an associate professor of archaeology at the University of Kansas. Hoops is an expert in pre-Columbian civilizations and has helped debunk the 2012 myth. But along the way, he's become fascinated with it and has gone from studying the myths of ancient Latin America to the myths of the modern-day United States. Sylvia caught up with Professor Hoops over the phone.
How did you first get interested in pre-Columbian civilizations?
I was a very avid fantasy and science fiction fan when I was in elementary school and junior high. Fantasy led me into science fiction, and then it was reading that stuff that led me into things like Chariots of the Gods and Carlos Castaneda and a lot of the other speculative literature of the early 70s.
That's interesting because that's some of where some of the stories about the Maya that is not are not so factual maybe spun out.
Well, that's exactly right. I think the Maya have always fascinated those people who were interested in science and interested in discovery, but also who had very vivid imaginations that they exercised quite freely.
Maybe we can take a step back and you can tell us a little bit about the Mayan civilization.
Well, it's a fascinating culture that has roots that go back well over 3,000 years. It's a complex story that begins with the very origins of social complexity in Mexico, a part of the world that we call Mesoamerica, and comes all the way up to the present day. In fact, there's 6 million living Maya alive today, and I think it's fair to say that Maya civilization is thriving.
And the Maya are known for having been very advanced mathematicians and astronomers for the age that in which they lived.
That's true, but I don't think that they were any more obsessed with math and the stars than were, for example, the ancient Greeks, who had a very highly advanced astronomy and astrology as well.
So is that part of the myth that we've sort of come to associate the Maya with being particularly connected to math and the stars?
Well, the sad story is that I think it's an example of cognitive dissonance. No one is surprised that the ancient Greeks, who were basically white people of the Mediterranean, were technologically advanced. It's a different story when people are asked to accept that people who didn't look like them, who had darker skin and who came from the Americas and were an indigenous people, actually had mathematics and astronomy and philosophy. So, ironically, I think racism plays a part in why people seem to be surprised that the indigenous peoples of Mexico were so, quote-unquote, advanced when they don't feel the same way about the Greeks.
The 2012 idea comes from the calendar. So I wonder if you can just explain how the Mayan calendar works.
Well, the Mayan calendar, unlike our calendar, is mostly based on a count of days as opposed to a count of years. And so the concept of year 2012 is really one that doesn't work in the Maya calendar very well. The Mayas were focused specifically on large cycles of time, increasingly larger cycles of time. The smallest unit was a day, which was called a quin. They also thought in terms of cycles of 20 days, of 360 days, of 7,200 days, of 144,000 days, and then we get into the sort of controversial area as to whether there were even larger cycles of 13 of those 144,000-day cycles to make up a big cycle, what was known as a great cycle, that would have had 1,872,000 days. But they kept track of these counts of days with these different units.
And that great cycle would be how many years?
That great cycle would be a little bit less than 5,126 years.
And that's the cycle that supposedly would end on December 21st, 2012.
That's correct. Either that or December 23rd. And I think it's fair to say that scholars are still disagreeing as to which correlation is correct, whether it would be the 21st or the 23rd.
And how did people come to believe that that meant that the Mayan believed that the world would end on that day, the end of, I guess, one of the great cycles?
Well, that's a really interesting question because it's something that doesn't come up really until the mid-20th century when you get a combination of the thinking pertaining to a document called the Dresden Codex, which is an ancient Maya book, and the interpretations of the Maya calendar. And long before there was any speculation about the date 2012 itself, although the calendar had actually been worked out, a scholar named Ernst Furstmann, a German scholar, had come to the conclusion that the Dresden Codex, on its very last page, had a depiction of a flood that represented the destruction of the world. But he never wrote about 2012. It wasn't until that interpretation becomes combined with Joseph Goodman's theory that there were these 13 Bakhtun cycles, the 5,125-point-something-day cycles, that the two kind of come together into this myth.
Is it the 13th one that's supposed to then end on that day, and they associated with those images of the Armageddon?
Well, it's not so much images of Armageddon. The images in the Dresden Codex show what's basically a giant snake with water pouring out of its mouth. What happens is that when Michael Coe combines these two concepts in his book, The Maya, which is published in 1966, he becomes the first person to link the notion of the end of the 13th Bakhtun with the concept of Armageddon.
And now, what do many academics think?
I don't think there are any academics who feel that the Maya indicated in any way that the end of the 13th Bakhtun would represent destruction. I think that sort of got hooked into the mythology, and there's very little support for it at all. In fact, there's really only one monument that refers to what will happen on that day, and it doesn't say anything about destruction at all.
And some believe that actually was a Western idea.
Well, that's right. That's part of my own thinking as well, is that there was a tremendous preoccupation with the end of the world right at the time that the civilizations of the Americas were being discovered. In fact, Christopher Columbus, of all people, was compiling something that he called the Libro de las Profecías, or the Book of Prophecies, around 1500, 1502, during his fourth voyage to the New World, which was when he actually first came in contact with people who were themselves in contact with the Mayas. And in his Libro de Profecías, he compiled references that came from ancient literature and from the Bible in support of what he felt was a prediction that the discovery of these most distant lands would bring about the sequence of events that were described in the Book of Revelation, and that his discovery of the New World would actually bring about the Second Coming and the events that were described at the end of the Bible. in the early years of contact, it became melded together into an eschatological syncretism in which Western ideas about the end of the world were overlaid on what were said to have been indigenous ideas.
As an archaeologist yourself, I would think that you might be highly annoyed at the propagation of this idea.
Well, annoyed, I'm annoyed at it the same way I'm annoyed by ancient aliens, in that it propagates what I see as a contemporary mythology about the ancient past, which ignores scholarship. It ignores the enormous hard work of scholars and graduate students and people who write dissertations and people who do archaeological field work and people who work very hard on academic books and attempting to figure all of this out in favor of what's essentially a very simplistic explanation that really doesn't explain very much at all.
But at the same time, it seems like you've also become interested in how, as a mythology, this 2012 phenomenon has come about.
Well, that's exactly right. And that's because I'm very interested in sort of the use of narratives about the past in the present, which I see as being something that's common to all religions, which tend to start with creation stories. And I see it as a really interesting phenomenon in contemporary society that may very well result in the creation of some new religious traditions. One of the phrases I like to use is the invention of sacred tradition, which comes from religious studies scholars James Lewis and Olaf Hammer, who put together a book with that title. But the invention of sacred tradition refers to this process of sort of creating mythologies to explain the past for the purpose of communicating a contemporary ethical and moral position.
And what is the 2012 story that you most frequently hear now?
The one that is most frequently propagated, actually there are two varieties. The one that I see most frequently is this end-of-the-world notion, which can be traced to, what's the best way to describe it, a lot of very avid commercialism on the part of book publishers and cable stations and programs like the History Channel, very much like the way they're promoting Ancient Aliens. It's something that enters into popular culture. Of course, Roland Emmerich's movie 2012 is the clearest expression of that. But I see that as far less interesting, to be perfectly honest, than the idea that 2012 might bring about a sort of new age transformation of consciousness, a new way of thinking about the world, a revolution in human thought and spirituality, which itself is kind of intriguing. I see it as being based in some of these other elements of contemporary mythology. But it is something that I think has much more juice in it as a philosophical issue.
Yeah, and that's where it's sort of related maybe to some of the other issues that we face today of the environment and war, maybe nuclear proliferation, all of that.
Well, that's exactly right. And ironically, interestingly, I think that Coe's use of the term Armageddon was one that he selected because back in the 60s, because of the Cold War, there was a lot of discussion about Armageddon, but back then it was nuclear Armageddon. But the type of apocalyptic experiences that people are discussing now have much more to do with the environment and with global warming and with social revolutions and with a variety of things that are happening around the world, economically, politically, which quite frankly have always been happening in one way or another. But we're much more aware and cognizant of them now because of digital networks and new modes of communication.
This is Casey Currents. We're speaking with John Hoops of KU's Department of Anthropology about the 2012 phenomenon. Now, how did this idea end up spreading?
It actually has roots that go back to the 19th century in the work of people like Helena Blavatsky and the Theosophical Society in the 1870s, 1880s. But then they also resonate in the beat culture of the 1950s. In fact, William S. Burroughs and Allen Ginsberg both had intense interests in the Maya. Burroughs went to Mexico in order to study ancient Maya writing, and Allen Ginsberg spent several months at Palenque in Chiapas, where he wrote poetry and actually did some archaeological exploration. So interest in the Maya enters the consciousness of a subculture through the beats. It then becomes very popular in the context of what became the ancestral grounds of Silicon Valley in the 1960s, in the context of counterculture at UC Berkeley and Stanford.
And these were people who were involved in the experimentation with psychedelic drugs. And
was part of sort of the hippie movement too, right?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, it was the Beats who sort of their hipness gave way to the hippies, and it was in the context of Northern California that people like Ken Kesey used LSD in the context of government-sponsored experiments, and this powerful psychedelic was also given to academics and scientists at Stanford University and at Berkeley. And interestingly, it was some of those same scientists who became early computer programmers.
Now, just taking a step back, what do you get from reviewing the origins of the 2012 myth? I wonder, what are you learning about us?
Well, what I'm seeing is an alternative history of the United States in one respect. I haven't seen as many histories of the counterculture as I would like to see. And I think that there are a lot of things that have influenced our music, our films, our books, our popular culture, that have deep roots in American history that go all the way back to the spiritual exploration of the founding fathers.
And what part, sort of more specifically, do you mean?
Well, for one, the tremendous variety of American religious experience, in particular the esoteric and the occult dimensions, which are out of the mainstream, but that nonetheless represent a very strong current in art and in philosophy and in music.
And they went on to influence the countercultural movements of the 60s.
Yes, that's right. Many of them had important influences on what's now known as the New Age movement, which is really an alternative spirituality. I think a phrase that's fairly common these days is to hear from people that they are spiritual but not religious. And when you look into what that means, often it will mean that they embrace alternative values that may come from Eastern religions, such as Buddhism or Hinduism, or they may come from Native American traditions, or they may come from other areas. Well, those ideas were introduced to American culture by this milieu of the late 19th century.
And where do you see this sort of new form of spirituality heading?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think a lot of it has to do with digital technology, and a lot of it has to do with the speed and rapidity with which we know things and think about them. And actually, waxing philosophical, I think that a better term than a transformation of consciousness would be a transformation of conscience. And what I mean by a transformation of conscience is how we think morally and ethically about the things that are happening in the world, which we now have far more access to than we ever did before.
Is that how you hope people will see or read this idea of this change or entering a new age in 2012?
Well, my feeling is that we're not really entering into a new age. I think our culture is constantly changing. Every single day is a new age or a new dawning. There are watershed times, but I'm skeptical that there will be any sort of foretold change in 2012. It is guaranteed to be a fascinating year. We have the Olympics. We have a presidential election, and so someone will come out in 2013 saying, oh, yes, I said this was going to happen, and it happened, and they will be able to spin that into whatever mythologies continue past that. But as I mentioned, I see it as a potentially significant religious phenomenon, and I like to point to things such as the Mormon Church or Scientology as examples of kind of American-born religions, which are pretty significant these days. And I would not be at all surprised if 2012 sparks some new religious movements.
John Hoops is an anthropology professor at KU. He has a blog on the website of Psychology Today and recently wrote a post called What You Should Know About 2012. Find a link to it on our website at kcur.org. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
In area news this week, arguments over what to do about unaccredited Kansas City schools heated. The Missouri legislature pondered another huge shortfall, and Boeing went back on a big promise to Kansas. Steve Bell recaps those and other top stories of the week on the KCUR Weekend News Review.
Today's announcement on the phase-out of Boeing's presence in Wichita is very disappointing to all of us. We're deeply saddened, Boeing Defense, at the end of this transition period, will no longer have operations in Kansas. Wichita has been at the company's operation core since 1929.
Governor Sam Brownback had been one of Boeing's biggest supporters when it was in Congress, fighting for a tanker contract the company got and will fulfill in Washington State. Brownback said the 2,100 laid off are likely to get work at other Kansas plants supplying private and commercial aviation, but little was said about the 7,500 expected new Boeing jobs that are now just a vapor trail in the western sky. Kansas City Mayor Sly James was fresh back from Washington and a visit with Secretary of Education Arne Duncan. He said Duncan had commented that based on graduation rates, the city's schools were among the worst in the nation, and that state legislators were already moving to dissolve the now unaccredited district.
There are two bills pending in the Senate that will disband the district, and there is nothing at this point that's filed that would stop that. We're drafting legislation that would certainly offer another alternative.
James also said he was
deliberately keeping the council out of it at this stage because it would turn totally political, which is exactly the opposite of what we want.
But Superintendent Steve Green said politics was already involved. Meanwhile, neighboring districts were refusing to accept transfers from the Kansas City district until financial details were worked out, and the ACLU was questioning that refusal. The 2012 session of the Missouri legislature convened amid concerns about two struggling school districts, Kansas City and St. Louis, and school funding in general. Plus, as State Senator David Pierce noted,
there are predictions anywhere from $400 to $900 million is going to be our shortfall for this upcoming year. So how do you fill that? So it's going to be tough.
Governor Nixon's budget director calls the cash shortage at $500 million. Nixon himself proposed borrowing $160 million for K-12 education from the state's colleges and universities, but he withdrew the proposal after it was rejected by House Speaker Stephen Tilley and other Republicans.
Unlike Washington, we won't balance our budget by borrowing from the taxpayers. And unlike our governor, we will not balance our budget by asking our state colleges and universities for a bailout.
The GOP majority also rejects the idea of any tax increase, including a proposal to raise the state's 17 cents a pack, lowest in the nation, cigarette tax. The Survivors Network of those abused by priests battled a court order to turn over a large batch of documents on people who had turned to the organization for help. David Clossy of SNAP called it bullying.
They don't just want to know which victims we talk to and help, which whistleblowers, which law enforcement officials seek our guidance. They clearly want to shut us down and scare deeply wounded people.
Lawyers for the Catholic Diocese contend that somewhere among the documents, there's likely to be one that proves that the plaintiff in a civil suit over sexual abuse violated a court gag order by sending information to SNAP. This is KCUR.
If you hear the word opera and think of a stuffy art form with horned helmets and a large singing lady, well, think again. A new opera co-commissioned by the Lyric Opera of Kansas City is based on Lois Lowry's The Giver, a popular but controversial novel about a dystopian society that's embraced sameness. KCUR's Laura Spencer reports.
New York-based composer Susan Kander has created a niche writing original operas for young adults, exploring themes from the Underground Railroad to girl bullies. Kander describes Lois Lowry's The Giver as the first book for many young people that truly talks up to them.
In fact, one of the reasons that I chose this book is that opera is at its best when it's talking about the gigantic issues, love and death. Nothing could be more appropriate as a choice for writing an opera, in my opinion.
The Giver tells the story of Jonas, who's born into a community where the goal is sameness. There's no conflict, no pain, and no color. 12 is a crucial age when each child is assigned a role. And Jonas is apprenticed to the Giver, who holds all the memories.
It was fascinating to go in and choose what I wanted to pursue, what I wanted to sort of blow up and look at more closely, things that lent themselves particularly to a musicalization. It was wonderful to work with her creation. That was just spectacular.
Author Lois Lowry says the story has been adapted for the stage, but not for opera until now. Lowry's written 40 books, and she says The Giver probably draws on the most sources, including childhood years spent in Japan after World War II. Her father was a career military officer. Lowry was 11 when her family moved from Pennsylvania, and she says she expected living overseas to be very different, but her parents chose an American-style house in a small, walled community.
I used to sneak out of the place we lived often and go by myself into the Tokyo that surrounded where I lived, and so I was attempting to experience something that was not the same, as I later described it in the book The Giver.
At a Monday night rehearsal at the Lyrics Opera Center at 18th and Charlotte, the cast of more than 30, mostly children ages 7 to 18, and a few adult cast members sing as a Greek chorus. It's used as a framework to bring the audience into the story. Ninth grader Jake Workman plays the role of Jonas. He says he'd read The Giver in school and did a project focusing on Jonas in eighth grade.
The music by Susan Kander is really great, but it's definitely challenging. And also the character development. Jonas has never experienced color or love or any really emotion in the book and the show. So, and no one has in their community. So it's hard to portray that.
In this scene, Workman, as Jonas, throws an apple to his friends and stops when it glimmers and shows a bit of color, something that doesn't exist in their society.
Asher, does anything seem strange to you about the apple?
Jumps out of my hands and onto the ground.
The Lyric Opera of Kansas City's education program celebrates its 20th anniversary this year. And education director Paula Winans says when they commission a work, they consider title recognition and if it's well-loved. She says The Giver speaks directly to youth, but the issues are universal.
You know, we often ask ourselves in situations, even in present-day life, would I have the courage to stand up or would I go along with the group in something that's a very serious situation? And Jonas has the courage.
Winans says the education program has created its own community over the years of young people and their families. She describes it as a place where children can find acceptance, where they can shine, and also find courage. Laura Spencer, KCUR News.
The Lyric Opera of Kansas City presents The Giver for schools on Thursday and Friday and the public on Saturday at the Rose Theater at Rockhurst High School. Author Lois Lowry will also speak after each performance. More information can be found on our website at kcur.org. Just click on Arts and Culture.
Thanks for tuning in to another KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page of kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast. Find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kccurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Sylvia with assistant producer Alex Smith. Kayla Regan is our intern, and our theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.